Thank you. Be seated. The court, and apparently nobody else, is ready to hear argument in the case of Holloway versus Skinner.
May it please the court, Mr. Scalawanda will present by Mr. Fisher to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, I'm Michael Scapolanda, and I'm here representing Graham Holloway. The first thing to note is this is not a whistleblower case. My client was an officer and a director of a corporation that bought a sandwich shop from the respondents, Alvin Oil Sandwich Shops for respondents. In the sale of the sandwich shop to the petitioner's corporation, the corporation agreed to pay respondent Mr. Skinner a promissory note and certain royalties on future sales of sandwiches. During the negotiation of the sale of this back in 1981, respondent Mr. Skinner asked for a personal guarantee from my client that my client would guarantee the note and the royalty payment. My client refused to do this, and the sale was consummated anyway. As with many small businesses, this business struggled and was not very successful. And my client, as president and sole acting director and chief operating officer of this corporation, had to make decisions on how they were going to prioritize debt, who was going to be paid, and when. Over the period of time, Mr. Skinner was sporadically and partially paid the monies owed him. I think he received some $90,000 between 1981 and 1985, largely through loans that my client made to the corporation to enable it to pay Mr. Skinner. Ultimately, the corporation stopped paying Mr. Skinner, and Mr. Skinner sued the corporation for breach of contract, received a judgment for breach of contract, and that judgment was unsatisfied, uncollected, because the corporation subsequently filed bankruptcy. So Mr. Skinner then sued my clients and various other people for tortiously interfering with the corporation's contract between the corporation and Mr. Skinner. The trial court, The jury found for Mr. Skinner, found that my client had tortiously interfered with the corporation's contract to Mr. Skinner. And the trial judge entered judgment based on the jury's verdict. That was appealed to the Court of Appeals, and they affirmed. Now, I have basically one major argument here, and that is that all the law in the state of Texas for the past 30, 40 years has been that a president of a corporation cannot tortiously interfere with the corporation's contracts, as long as the president is acting within the scope of his or her duties to the corporation. The corporation cannot decide when to enter contracts by itself and cannot decide when to breach contracts by itself or how to prioritize debt, decide who's going to get paid, who's not. Somebody has to do that on behalf of the corporation. And that job fell to my client, who was president and chief operating officer of this corporation. So when he failed to write the check to Mr. Skinner, Mr. Skinner's allegation is that failure to write the check constituted tortious interference. All of the Texas law, going back to 1954, has said that the president, the agent of the corporation, cannot interfere as long as that agent is acting within the scope of their duties. In this case, there is no allegation that Mr. Holloway was acting outside the scope of his duties. In fact, the plaintiff's respondents' pleadings below allege that Mr. Holloway, as president, acting in his capacity as president, failed to write the check. The Court of Appeals seemed to suggest a variation on this theme, and that is that a corporate agent could be liable for tortiously interfering with the contract if the agent was not acting in good faith and not acting for the best interest of the corporation. This would seem to be a reasonable alternative. I think acting within the scope of the duty is the proper standard. But the Court of Appeals, although they misapplied it, their standard of good faith and in the best interest of the corporation seems to me to be a reasonable standard. And that is that if the corporate agent is not acting in good faith and for the best interest of the corporation, possibly is acting outside of his capacity as corporate agent. But there is absolutely no evidence in this record that Mr. Holloway was acting, and no allegation that Mr. Holloway was acting in anything but for the best interest of the corporation. The first standard, the standard that the director, the officer, should not be liable if he's acting within the scope of his duties, I think is the better standard, because the second standard, good faith and in the best interest of the corporation standard, really is the corporation's claim that the agent has fallen below what the agent should be doing. And Mr. Skinner, as a shareholder of that corporation, it seems to me, could have brought a shareholder derivative suit alleging that that Mr. Holloway was not acting in the best interest of the corporation. In this case, it is undisputed that Graham Holloway was president, director, and 40% shareholder of the corporation. The main focus here, I think, is the agency relationship between the corporation and Mr. Holloway. Unlike the stranger to the corporation, and unlike even the shareholder of the corporation, the president acts with respect to contracts. As I said before, acts with respect to when contracts are entered into, how to prioritize debt, etc. The stranger to a corporation who induces a corporation to breach a contract does not so act normally with respect to the corporation's contract and may be called upon to justify the action. Although it's a closer case, I think the shareholder of a corporation does not normally act with respect to the corporation's contract. And there may be some justification for requiring the shareholder to justify the actions. But what the respondents argue for and what the Court of Appeals held below is that each and every time a corporate officer decides, I'm not going to write a check this month, we don't have the money to pay, that a prima facie case of tortious interference has been made. Just briefly paraphrase the elements of tortious interference, a contract subject to interference. Well, there's no doubt that there was a contract subject to interference here. Act of willful or intentional interference. My clients decided not to write a check. I guess that is an act of willful and intentional non-payment of this corporate debt. And that caused Mr. Skinner some damage. Given
where there are two debts, though, and there's just enough money to pay for one, and the corporate officer is individually liable on one but not on the other, and chooses to pay the one that he might be held individually liable on, is that improper?
Okay, there are two debts. One, there's individual liability, and the other one, there's not individual liability.
Is that an interference?
I don't believe it is, because in that case, and that wasn't alleged here, but in that case, there could be, and we've been talking about mixed motives all morning, I guess, so we can talk about mixed motives some more. There may be mixed motives, as the court, the Caton Court in Georgia, the Georgia Supreme Court said, any act of a small corporation where assets are preserved for the corporation benefit the shareholders, benefit the people that are at the corporation. And so that's going to happen any time there's a decision to pay one debt or another. But in any case, in this case, there's been no allegation and no proof that...
there's no allegation that he paid debts where he might be held individually liable and did not pay those where he had no individual responsibility?
The main other debt that was the focus of the trial was debt to United Bank. And the debt to the United Bank, there was some individual liability on those debts, and then there was some sole corporate liability on those debts. Another shareholder, Gene Culligan, my client's mother-in-law, was attempting, because the debts to United Bank were not being met, and basically the United Bank debt was secured. And if United Bank called the debt foreclosed, the whole operation would have been shut down and nobody would have been paid. The corporation would have ceased to exist, and United Bank threatened to do that on several occasions. So in that situation, it wasn't the case of Mr. Holloway deciding, well, this is going to benefit me personally better than it's going to benefit the corporation. United Bank said, if you don't pay, we're going to close you down.
He made the decision then to pay the secured debt as opposed to an unsecured debt.
Exactly, because that meant the life or the death of the corporation. And there were other instances where he went without salary for a period of time or was late in paying his own salary. There were instances where other creditors were not paid. So it was an issue of who can we afford to not pay? Because all these other people will shut us down if we don't pay.
Mr. Caprilino, I'm a little bit confused. Are you conceding that the law as stated by the Court of Appeals is essentially correct, that an agent who is out, that an agent to be immune from liability for tortious interference has to be acting in the best interest of the corporation? I can't tell by your argument, but you seem to say that's reasonable.
Well, my main point is that should not be the law, and has not been the law. The law is, in all the other cases cited, the law is, has the agent acted in his or her capacity as agent? And that's the sole question. My second point was, if for some reason you want to change that, if you decide that that is not the best law to apply, that that should not be the legal standard, the good faith in the best interest of the corporation would be an alternative. I think it's a less desirable alternative, but it would be an alternative. But I think the Court of Appeals misapplied it.
You don't think that the president paying himself a salary increase when he's not meeting other bills is not a tortious interference, because paying himself a greater salary in lieu of paying the debts is in the best interest of the corporation or something?
Well, three things here in on the salary point. First, Mr. Skinner and Mr. Holloway were both making $36,000 a year when they started. They agreed to take a temporary salary cut to $24,000. At the time of the breach, Mr. Holloway was making $33,000, so less than his original salary. He had also taken on many, many other tasks, general contractor for store renovations, et cetera, and had laid off many of the different management personnel, so was doing much more. So one, the salary decreased temporarily and then rose. It rose some more after the breach, but a couple of things with respect to that. Although the salary rose some after that, again, Mr. Holloway was taking on more responsibility. And second, Mr. Holloway, in addition to taking on more responsibility, the breach, the total and material breach, had already occurred. The corporation had already breached the contract. So what happens after that seems to me to be less material. But the main point is, that the salary increase came as a result of, one, arriving at the original salary, and two, taking on more responsibility.
Is that not really a fact issue that we can't really review up here?
It seems to me that's looking at the wrong facts. Because in any case, in any corporate case, there are going to be questions about who you paid and how you prioritized your debt. That ought to be the corporate officer's prerogative. Now, if you are an individual and you enter into a contract and you sign a note and you fail to pay it, we don't care about your motive. It doesn't matter why you stopped paying. It doesn't matter if you stopped paying because you had other interests that were better served by paying other debts, or just other interests served by not paying at all. It doesn't matter. You're liable in contract for not paying your debt. But in that breach of contract case, we don't really care what motivated you to breach your contract. And so the same thing ought to apply here with a corporate officer decides not to pay a bill. That is a breach of the corporation's contract, and the motive shouldn't be material at all. In any tortious interference case, what the court is doing is balancing the interest of the one harmed by the breach of contract against the interest of the other party and the interest of society. In this case, the plaintiff's interests have been partially dashed. The plaintiff in a corporation that struggled its whole life was paid a significant portion, most of which came indirectly out of my client's pocket through loans to the corporation. Also, in this case, Mr. Skinner had a lowered expectation of receiving this money. He attempted to negotiate for a personal guarantee from Mr. Holloway. Mr. Holloway did not give him that personal guarantee. And so with the lack of guarantee, Mr. Skinner knew up front that he was going to have to look to the corporation for satisfaction of this debt.
The effect of affirming the Court of Appeals would be to give a guarantee where one was not given as a result of the arm's length negotiation of the party?
Not only give a guarantee where it wasn't given, but give it with a premium. Because this is basically a risk allocation case. And that is that in 1981, the risk was allocated to Mr. Skinner that the corporation would fail and not be able to pay the debts. Mr. Holloway refused to take the risk. Knowing full well, Mr. Skinner went ahead. Mr. Skinner's attorney, Mr. Fowler at the time, shortly after the deal, said that he doubted the corporation's ability to pay these debts. United Bank doubted the viability of the company. Pete Marwick doubted the viability of the company. Mr. Skinner doubted the viability of the company. So the risk was realized. And can I continue answering the question? The risk was realized. And now that the risk has been realized and it's adverse to Mr. Skinner, he would have this court reassign the risk to Mr. Holloway, place a premium, the premium of punitive damages, on that risk. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Mr. Neal, to present argument from respondent.
If it pleases the court, Mr. Skinner comes to this court affirmed by the trial court, affirmed by the Court of Appeals. But the real issue I think we're talking about today is accountability. The accountability of corporate officers to do what they're supposed to do in running corporations and not to use their own personal vendettas against other people and other customers and other shareholders of the corporation. I quote from the Supreme Court of Montana, "The corporate veil should not be utilized as a protective device by those who employ corporate power or authority to serve their own ends. And tort liability for the inducement of breach of contract should be imposed when a corporate agent, employee, officer, or director induces a breach of contract for private benefit or because of personal feelings and purposes relative to the third party. Because the privilege of limited liability should only be applicable in those situations where actions are motivated and taken in furtherance of the corporate purposes, policies, and interests. And this court in Maxey, it said exactly that. You can only do these things in good faith and for the best interest of the corporation.
Well, it's a vendetta, counsel.
Court, there was substantial testimony that during the course of the parties' time together, Mr. Skinner was threatened that if he did not sell out the rest of his interest in the corporation and sell out his interest in the royalty agreement, that he would not get another cent from this corporation. And that is exactly what happened. He did not get one further cent after that threat was made.
He sued the corporation.
He sued the corporation.
He got a judgment against the corporation.
Unsatisfied.
And is there any claim here that Mr. Holloway took some of the assets of the corporation?
There's no individually. There's no, well, the claim is that it was proved at the trial, obviously, that he obtained higher salaries and had took salaries for his wife who didn't have salaries before, I believe, that he paid his American Express card out of the corporate facilities. He paid his mother-in-law back on her debt, but refused to pay on this debt. But one of the very telling points is that he refused to pay the royalties for which he was a fiduciary. He breached his fiduciary duty. These are royalties coming into his corporation, and he's not supposed to use them. He's not supposed to play with them. He's supposed to directly turn them over to Mr. Skinner, and he did not. It took, finally took an order in bankruptcy court to make him do it. But I say to this court, that's a real breach. And that's one of the things that I think we're really talking about. That really shows.
But it's a corporate breach, isn't it?
No. I think it's not a corporate breach when he is the fiduciary. He is the one in control of those funds that are coming in. I don't think we can say that if a bank president comes in and takes money from the bank, knowing that it's not his money, and hands it out over here, are we going to say that that bank president, knowing that he has a fiduciary obligation, is no longer liable? How long can we hide behind this corporate veil? This is not a hard situation, it seems to me. That they had a very valid opportunity in front of this jury. They gave them the question that they wanted, and they couldn't meet their burden of proof.
Mr. Neal, let me ask you a question before proceed with your argument. Do you contend that Mr. Holloway, when he made decisions as to pay some secured debt and not unsecured debt, that he was acting outside the scope of his duties?
Well, I think there are times when he was acting outside the scope of his duties. And I really think that's what Maxey is trying to tell us.
But in deciding as to what many bills to pay, and he certainly couldn't pay all of them, I take it, because the business was failing. Is that something that was in his discretion, within his duties?
I think it's the total impact of all the things he did that brought the jury to conclude that he was not doing it in good faith and in the best interest of the corporation and didn't follow through. I know when he comes down to a particular, I don't think we can analyze this case as a particular bill case. And I don't think, because there are lots of bills that anybody within a corporation, a comptroller in a corporation, will say, you have to pay. But when you start prioritizing those bills and when you take money that doesn't belong to you and add that to the stack that you're going to use, then it seems to me that decision of what to pay, you have muddied the water to a considerable extent.
How do you respond to Mr. Scarpa-Linda's characterization of this case? This is a risk allocation case.
Well, I know that's what he would like for it to be.
Mr. Holloway refused to give a personal guarantee for the corporate debts, and now this is what you're after. And it would let the Court of Appeals opinion stand. Piggyback Justice Cornyn's question, is that the effect of the Court of Appeals decision, that a corporate officer would be liable even though he refused to give a personal guarantee on the corporate debt?
when you do not have the overlay of the threat that if you don't sell out to the, you know, former water softener paying people, if you don't pay to those people, this is a threat that overlies this entire case. And I think that's what the jury saw and believed. I don't think you can come down and say, no, this is not really, we're not really talking about guaranteeing a single debt of the corporation because Mr. Holligan decided not to pay that particular debt. Because in every case, it seems to me the very, very instance of trying to find good faith, and the Court of Appeals say good faith means no more than the intent to benefit the corporation. Now that's a real low standard. And if you can't meet that low standard, then he shouldn't be in a corporate position taking advantage of other people.
Did you concede today? Mr. Holloway, one of the debtors, did he, when the corporation went bankrupt, did they owe him too?
Mr. Holloway?
Yes.
I don't know, Your Honor. I'm just handling that part of the case.
I thought that the counsel said that he loaned money to the corporation in order that the corporation could continue to operate.
Mr. Holligan and his father-in-law obtained loans, but as far as I can read the case, it is real murky about which loans they were paying. Originally, the original deal, as I understand it, was struck that they were to provide the financing for this corporation. And as it happened, I think a lot of the financing was not provided by them, that it was for the corporation to come in and pay later. So that their interest would essentially come in ultimately, if the corporation had survived, as free of any money they actually put in. But they were just securing loans, as it actually turned out. And those loans were being paid back by the corporation as best the corporation could. But eventually the family came in and bought the loans from United Bank. So I don't know that, you know, in answer to your question, if it is a liability that he had or might have had, I think it all ended up in mom-in-law's hands. So the answer, I think, is that there's probably some there. The corporation may have owed him something. But yet he was in control of everything. And when he uses that control to hurt others or to benefit himself, then he's not acting appropriately.
He just doesn't want to loan any more money. He just wants to cut and run. That could be interference with contract.
It's possible, but if he's doing it for the best interest of the corporation, saying this corporation can't survive any longer, and hasn't threatened the other shareholders.
That was true, wasn't it? It didn't survive any longer.
Well, it survived for several years after the threat was made.
Well, but and during that period of time, monies were paid.
No monies were ever paid to Mr. Skinner after the threat was made. After that threat was made, he did not receive one further cent.
So it's got to happen almost immediately after.
Well, I think if you're going to use your corporate position to say, you know, I'm not going to pay you any more money, and I'm going to grind you into the ground because I've got my mother-in-law who has millions of dollars behind me, I don't think that's appropriate.
Mother-in-law is a shareholder?
Mother-in-law was a 40% shareholder, or approximately 40%.
Doesn't the officer at a corporation owe fiduciary duties to the shareholder?
I think they do.
And under your scenario, though, there would be a conflict between the duty that the officer would owe a creditor of the corporation and the duty that the officer owes the shareholders in the corporation, wouldn't it?
Well, I think the duty is owed to creditors of the corporation first.
You do. There's a what kind of duty is that?
That they are not going to misuse.
Contractual duty?
Well, I think it's an ethical duty. That the overlay is that you do not try to benefit yourselves out of the assets of this corporation.
How about a shareholder?
Well, a shareholder shouldn't have as much control, but if they do, same thing with the shareholders. Anybody who is in control of this corporation, whether it's officer, director, or shareholder, I don't think can motivate themselves to come in and say, we are going to rate this corporation for our benefit, and all you creditors out there, just tough luck. The creditors have the first right to the assets of the corporation if they're owed. Only secondarily are the shareholders, bondholders, directors, officers, whatever their rights may exist. they only come secondary to, those are the creditors on the outside of the corporation. They're not entitled to rate that corporation under Texas law. And I think that's exactly what was trying to happen here. It just didn't get very far before the corporation folded, or before the causes of action were filed and the claims of Mr. Skinner were brought forward.
Conversely, if the shareholders took assets out of a corporation that was insolvent, did not pay its bills, creditors could go after the shareholders to recover those assets.
Yes, sir. They have a direct right against those people who take those assets.
If the corporation has no assets, or rather the shareholders pulled no assets out of the corporation that was insolvent, they just simply chose to pay some bills that were owed as opposed to some other bills were owed, you would insist that there is an additional cause of action of tortious interference, such that if an officer made the wrong decision on who to pay, that the officer picks up personal liability independent of any assets the officer may have received from the corporation for having made an improper decision on who to pay.
No, Your Honor, that's not my claim at all. The question, if it's if you say, I don't know what the court's terminology of improper is.
Well, you're saying that if it's not in the benefit of the corporation, and I'm assuming at some point some independent third party, a jury or a judge, would be making a hindsight determination of whether that decision that the officer made on who to pay was not proper under whatever definition you provide.
Well, the legislature, I think, has entered the realm somewhat in that area, that on the very end of the crisis of a corporation, that those assets do not have to be paid pro rata. They're not going to make an absolute sense that everybody's paid pro rata from all the assets of a corporation. But it has to be done in a fair manner. And I think this was not done in a fair manner. Not when you see all the avenues of money coming to them, seeing the threats that were coming to them. I think that's to change the total atmosphere of this case. If you have just a corporation that's failing and it sits there and it pays legitimate debts at a time when there's no animus that exists between these people, then I think, yes, you can go ahead and pay those debts. We're not saying that this is an absolute guarantee of every debt of a corporation and all officers have to pay. This is one of the few torts that agents of a corporation seemingly don't walk right in and grab. There are many cases, intentional infliction of mental distress case, out of the Garantano case. Those folks walk in, they plead interference with a contract, they don't get it because they said it's, and I think wrongly, they said it's not within the scope of their authority, but they acted within the scope of their authority and didn't go through the Maxey and Sterner test. But again, at the end, they say the court finds that you were guilty of the tort of infliction of mental distress. Now, these are all intentional torts. We're not talking about that you negligently failed to pay this bill or you negligently did something else. This is an intent, and the jury found the intent. This is an intentional tort that they did something on purpose to interfere with this man's contract. And when you do that, I think we have to lower the corporate veil and say to these people, you cannot do this in this day and age. We are not going to allow you to rape a corporation and come back in here and keep the money for yourself. We are not going to allow you to try and manipulate the corporation. You cannot do that in this day and age. And it's time that I think that all the intentional torts, that all agents have always been liable for committing their own intentional torts, from assault and battery to slander to infliction of mental distress. And I think it's time that this one stand on its own also.
And the tort here is interfering with a contract?
Intentional interference with the contract. And I'm not talking about those cases that are on the outskirts.
Deciding what bill to pay and what not, and others not to pay. What are the elements of this tort? What is the evidence of the tort here?
This court held in Victoria Bank and Trust versus Brady that you have to have an existence of a contract subject to interference, an act of interference that was willful and intentional, the intentional act was the proximate cause of the damages, and you had an actual damage or loss.
That was not a situation where we had a corporate officer that was being sought to pay certain debts, or to be liable for the debt of a corporation.
That was the traditional intentional interference with the corporate intentional interference with the contract litany. But the court has gone on to say that there have been two types of tests that let you out of this. The privilege test, the justification test. The maxi test, if it's in good faith, best interest of the corporation, there is no liability for the corporate officer. That should be a very easy test for a corporate officer to meet. The Starter versus Marathon Oil justification test. Interference was done in a bona fide exercise of the defendant's own right. And the defendant's interest in the contract subject to matter was equal or superior to the plaintiff's. Now, those are two. They came as questions to the jury. They're defensive, affirmative defense questions, and they had an opportunity before the jury, and he missed that opportunity. He did not meet his burden of proof.
So if I understand your argument correctly, these are intentional torts. So you can never get, and because intent is a matter of a fact for the jury to find, these type of cases could never be resolved by summary judgment. All corporate officers from here on out will be called to task and have jury trials to determine whether or not they intentionally interfered with contracts. If in this type of situation where they have some debts, they can't pay them all.
Well, it's certainly a possibility that might happen, but it's certainly the possibility that every time any corporate officer makes a speech to anybody, that someone's going to sue them for slander. Any time that he does something and hurts the employees of his company, that he might be held responsible for intentional infliction of mental distress. That if he assaults somebody in the corporate, by being president of this corporation, all of those things are true. I'm not saying that this is what's going to happen in this world, but I think it's time that we say you cannot hide in this corporation and allow these things to go on.
Did Skinner receive a salary? I heard counsel say
he received a salary, as I recall, of $24,000 prior before he being dismissed by the corporation. There was from the very beginning of the corporation to when he was dismissed, the parties began to rankle between themselves. The Holligan faction wanted to rev up the corporation, make more places to eat, and as a result, they got strung out. And they weren't looking at what they were at doing this in a moderate fashion. They thought they could be a Schlotsky's business overnight. And they had tried to, as the record revealed, they went to Schlotsky's and tried to buy Schlotsky's and was unable to do so because they didn't want to do it on a merger and a buyout situation that Mr. Skinner was willing to do. This is a much, much smaller operation. And to rev it up and create that much debt in a very short period of time, they just couldn't handle it. The management was not very good. Mr. Skinner was pushed out, and then all of a sudden, he's told, if you don't allow us to buy you out of the rest of your stock interest and your loyalty agreement and cancel your note, you aren't going to get another penny. And that threat has been met out. He never got another penny. When the court looks at the situation and says, public policy-wise, are all these people going to get hurt? Are all these corporate presidents going to get tagged? And I say, no, they're not, because they're all going to be doing what they're supposed to be doing in the normal corporation. I give the case, it's a conversion case, but it's a Norton case, it's quoted in the brief. Mr. Norton's head of a trucking company. And instead of doing what he's supposed to be doing as a president, he intentionally interferes not only with the trucking contract that he has with one client, but he interferes by doing so with the contract between his client and another buyer of fruit. And he holds up the load of fruit, and it's beginning to spoil, but he's going to hold it up because he's owed a debt by one of the parties. Now, that case came down in a conversion case, but it's still a tort case, and it seems to me could equally have been intentional interference with a contract. I think, we got the Leonard Duckworth case and the Field case. That's not a corporate officer dealing with his own contract, but the Fifth Circuit said, we are not going to allow this type of activity to happen We are not going to allow you to come in and stop the action that's happening and reap the benefit and interfere with those contracts.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Commissioner. You may proceed.
Just a couple of quick points in response to Mr. Neal. The corporation paid Mr. Skinner for a period of time and in 1985 committed a total and material breach of the contract. Mr. Neal characterized the preceding months leading up to that breach as one where Mr. Skinner was threatened. If he didn't sell out, he wouldn't receive any more money. There's absolutely no evidence that Mr. Holloway threatened Mr. Skinner and said, if you don't sell out, we're not.
On this debt to United Bank, was Mr. Holloway on that note personally?
There were, as I understand it, two notes, and he was on one and not on the other.
But then his mother-in-law eventually bought them both?
Right. She eventually bought both.
And so she was the one that the corporation owed the money to when it folded.
Actually, when it folded, the largest two creditors were Gene Culligan, the mother-in-law, and Mr. Holloway. So when this corporation folded, they were the two that were hurt the most by this, and not Mr. Skinner. I want to be clear about what I'm arguing as to the legal standard, because apparently I didn't do a real good job of that the first time around. And that is that I think the legal standard has been in the state of Texas, that a corporate officer cannot be liable for interfering with the contracts of the corporation if he or she is acting within the scope of his authority. And that, I think, is the proper standard. The second standard, the good faith and in the best interest of the corporation standard, that is really a duty owed to the corporation. And it's really the corporation who should be heard to complain if they feel that the officer or director is not acting in good faith and in the best interest of the corporation. What I merely meant to say before was that if for some reason this court does not feel that the scope of the duty standard is the proper one, the good faith and best interest of the corporation could work, but was misapplied by the court of appeals below, and this is why it was misapplied.
Mr. Skinner doesn't allege that he was wrongfully discharged.
No.
It was a meeting, an agreed on separation when he left the corporation.
I don't recall what the facts of the separation were. But basically the court
prior to that, part of the money he had received from the corporation was a salary, and part of it was some sort of royalty of some sort?
He had received three forms of payment from the corporation. Salary, partial note payments and interest payments on the note, and partial royalty payments. And that was sporadic over the years.
Well, did he continue to receive note payments after he was no longer getting a salary?
For a couple of years, I believe. I think he severed his relationship maybe in 1980.
Did he continue to receive royalty payments after that?
Yes, until both of those were received until 1985 when they stopped.
85 is when they went bankrupt?
I'm not sure when the bankruptcy occurred. It may have been a little bit.
But for the rest of the corporate life, you're not certain whether he continued to receive the royalty payments or the note payments?
No, I think after 85 he didn't receive any more payments. But his relationship was severed prior to
that. Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the oral argument in these three causes, which are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments. And the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience will